Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our guest today to start the show is Mary Phillips. She has led the National Wildlife Federation's Garden for Wildlife program since 2014, and it is the nation's oldest and largest backyard habitat program. So we're going to talk to her about what goes into creating native habitats and how it helps wildlife. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments, or maybe your own experiences as you've tried to do this in your own backyard. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Mary Phillips, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. I'd love to be here.
Well, you know, maybe to begin, let's talk about the National Wildlife Federation itself. It's been around for a long time. How did it get started?
Sure. So it's been around since 1936. And it was the reason we have federation in our name is because it really was a federation of hunters and anglers and gardeners and so many different groups that came together and were very concerned about the decline of wildlife even then, and formed the federation. And it's been going strong since then. And we're now national. We have affiliate in every state. And we also have 25 of those affiliates really are Garden for Wildlife champions and doing a lot in their states. And then also we have a number of regional offices.
And maybe tell us about some of the programs that the National Wildlife Federation supports. Obviously, this Gardening for Wildlife is one for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a combination of on-the-ground grassroots programming. Our environmental justice area has really been taken off in the last 5 years, where we're working in communities to really see how environmental challenges impact a variety of communities on the ground and what we can do there. We do a lot of policy work. We actually are promoting the Recovering of America's Wildlife Act, which will actually allow for funding to go to state agencies, including Wisconsin DNR, to implement their wildlife plans. So there's a lot on the policy side that we do, but there's also a lot. We have a very strong schoolyard habitat and eco-schools program, as well as our sacred grounds program, which is where people are creating habitat and places of worship. And in each of our regions, they actually do a lot of on-the-ground work with specific watershed restoration and so forth.
So you have the NWF as the nation's oldest and largest backyard habitat initiative. I was way ahead of the curve. What prompted its creation?
Well, we were so lucky. We had an amazing naturalist called Craig Tufts, and he had a vision for expanding this program nationally, but it was based on research in 1972 that two U.S. Forest Service researchers did that actually showed what wildlife managers were using for large-scale restoration, food, water, cover, and places to raise young actually worked on a smaller scale in backyards. So after that report came out, Garden for Wildlife was launched at National Wildlife Federation, and the core of Garden for Wildlife has been the Certified Wildlife Habitat Program, where we recognize people for putting those elements with native plants in their yards. And we're now over 270,000 properties that have had that designation.
You know, as you think about it, we've lost, I mean, this country, the world really has lost a lot of wildlife habitat over the years in the large sense. And so you can make an argument, I think, that the backyards, if you added them all up and everybody was working on this, it would be quite an achievement.
Yes, it really would. Approximately about 2 million acres a year disappear from habitat due to urban expansion, urban suburban expansion. So the more, and that's why this program is so critical, the more we can help people take the property that they own and can steward it for wildlife and live in harmony with wildlife where they live, it can make a difference correcting that numbers and providing those migratory pit stops for so many essential species.
Let's talk about native plants and adding native plants to your garden. What are the advantages of that?
Gosh, native plants, I'm obviously very passionate about native plants.
Sure.
But one of the reasons is that as soon as you have them in your space, you're going to start seeing amazing wildlife come through. Literally within a season, you're going to see the butterflies, the bees, and the birds. And one of the reasons is so many native plants have co-evolved to support specific types of species, and particularly what we call host plants. And a lot of these host plants support numbers, high numbers of Lepidoptera, which are butterflies and moths. And not only do we want to support those populations, but we want to plant enough so that those populations, their caterpillars, their young and other insects support the 96% of birds who rely on them to survive. So those are all kind of the interconnected impacts. Not only that, native plants have amazing root systems that are really good for sequestering carbon and also channeling stormwater runoff and helping the watershed. So it's like a full package with your native plant.
And if you're a gardener who's kind of new to natives, I know a lot of people say, well, what the heck am I going to plant? What's best for my area? And you have some answers for that. Maybe talk about the NWF's Garden for Wildlife program a bit more.
Sure. So Garden for Wildlife has a number of resources. For Wisconsin specifically, we just launched some new, actually, DIY starter garden collections of native plants, and that's at gardenforwildlife.com, and we actually have it by state, what is really great in your state. And what these are based on is making sure that we have a combination of native plants that provide three seasons of bloom, as well as their high performers, what we call power plants, the keystone plants. And this is based on our partner's work, Dr. Doug Tallamy, who has actually identified keystone native plant species that support 90% of wildlife in a given area. So we're able to provide that. So we have some, we just launched this last year because the demand has been so high for native plants. Our program, the habitats, has more than doubled in the last couple years. But everyone asks, like, where can we find these plants? So we actually are working with a Wisconsin grower. So the plants that you see on site are grown in Wisconsin and shipped directly to your door. Other, for larger lists of native plants, particularly trees, because we don't have those yet, you can go to our NWF.org native plant finder and put your zip code in, and that will give you trees, shrubs, grasses, a variety of plants by zip code that are perfect for where you live.
Yeah, it's interesting. This, I'm thinking about Wisconsin and our various zones. I'm sure there are states that have a lot of zones, and how'd you get past all that? It had to be a lot of work.
It really has been an exciting challenge. But what we're doing as we launched this for the native plants that we're distributing in Wisconsin is we're working at the ecoregion level one. So the plants are native to Wisconsin and some other states in that ecoregion level one area. So that's how we're starting. And as we grow the grower network, we're hoping to be more specific with a more variety of plants that are actually native to more specific lower level zones.
Our guest today, Mary Phillips, she leads the National Wildlife Federation's Garden for Wildlife programs. Questions for her, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us to ideas@WPR.org. So do you plant for wildlife, to help wildlife? What would you like to know about providing habitat in your yard? Maybe questions about selecting plants. Give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. So when you mail, how do the plants arrive, by the way?
They arrive in a lovely box with that are supported with a clamshell type of made out of recycled plastic that holds the plant inside so that it's not damaged during shipment. And we also provide a wonderful insert that has a link to digital design for that particular collection, some recommendations for planting layout and planting tips. Those are all components of what you receive when you open your box.
So it sounds like they're going to arrive in pretty good condition then.
Yeah, they do. We launched this last year in a pilot mode and tested it out and really had some great success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been fortunate with the carriers. They have treated the plants good so far. So we hope that continues. But the way they're packaged really does minimize any kind of damage. And they are starter plants. They have a deep developed root system, and then about depending on what time of the year you receive them, between 3 and 8 inches of foliage. So they're a little shorter right now, but they'll be bigger.
Yeah, and I'm wondering about that in terms of, so we could order those, I could sit down and order those today. I don't think I'd be planting tomorrow,
yeah.
But...
well, yes, actually I'd recommend ordering them tomorrow on National Gardening Day, because we're offering an amazing special to honor National Gardening Day and Native Plant Month, which April has been recently designated as. So it would be at gardenforwildlife.com to find the Wisconsin plants. And one of the things I want to tell you, there's really exciting collections in there. There's one called the Spring Bee Buffet, which actually is for the early spring bees that come out that need, you know, nectar and pollen early on before all the leaves have filled in the trees. And that's something, you know, you'd want to order right now, because that's one that will only ship through the end of May, because as it gets hot, we wouldn't want to be shipping that one. But then we have some amazing, what we're calling Monarch Munchables and Pollinator Power. Monarch Munchables is for full sun. Pollinator Power is for part shade. And we have, again, in each of those, really high-performing keystone plants. And when I mentioned that, we not only looked at the butterfly and moth data, we looked at the pollen specialist bees. And pollen specialist bees are those bees that can only really survive with specific plants. But there are some plants that support really high numbers of different pollen specialist bees. So that's how we design these particular collections.
Let's take some calls. Jim in Camp Douglas, we'll go to you first. Thank you for calling, Jim. What's on your mind?
Well, I snagged some milkweed seed from the pods last fall before they blew away. And I planted them a couple days ago in three different areas, but I've got them pretty concentrated as far as seeds go. And I was wondering, one, will they sprout? Not all, of course, but, and if they do, can I transplant them so I can spread them out a little bit further?
And did you literally put them in the soil, Jim, or how did you plant them?
I took some good black soil that I had bought at one of the local shops in the area. So I've got about a 3-inch base of good black dirt. It's compost and things like that. So,
and the seeds are within that 3-inch pile of dirt, or the layer of dirt. Okay.
I got three different places I put them, but and I tamped them down and buried them about a 1/2 inch.
Okay. Mary, what do you think?
Well, that's wonderful. My one question is, when you harvested the seeds, where were they kept over the winter? Were they kept outside, and were they able to stay cold? Because milkweed seeds really do need a cold stratification period. I know for Wisconsin, I know it's still a little cold there, so you still have a little bit of time for that. Were you able to keep them cold and allow for that over the storage process?
Right. I put them in a paper grocery bag so that it wouldn't draw any moisture. And I had them in a dry, cool place in my garage, which is not heated.
Okay.
Oh, okay. That should be.
That good. Should be fine.
Mm-hmm. And then the one thing about transplanting, a lot of native plants, they don't always love transplanting, but depending on how strong their root base is, once they grow a bit, you could potentially move those out a little bit and expand them in that space once they get situated. But again, keeping in mind, particularly in cold weather states, your milkweed is not going to germinate till much later in the spring season, really late May, early June. Again, depending on how temps are and how cold, or actually how quickly the soil warms up.
All right. Jim, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Lucy in Eau Claire will give you a chance. Hi, Lucy.
Hey, hi. Good to hear from you guys. Say, I have a restored native prairie that I did about like 20 years ago when I moved in here, originally from Milwaukee. So this was always a dream of mine, and I have a beautiful prairie. I've burned for the first time, believe it or not, last year, but because of the regulations, you have to get the okay before you can burn. And whenever the wind is good, so you get a nice hot fire, they say no. So I didn't get a real hot fire, but what are your thoughts about burning a prairie in your neighborhood?
Well, I think it is absolutely key to your point about obeying local regulations around burns, particularly where there's a lot of houses. I think the folks that obviously are doing DNR and others who are doing large-scale restoration definitely do control burns, and I think that's really important. I think it is a bit challenging if you're in a residential area that way, that you have to follow those fire laws, basically. But, I mean, you are correct. Prairie plants do benefit from a controlled burn. Normally in nature, in the larger prairie, you know, that happens through lightning strikes and other things throughout nature's natural cycle. So, I understand trying to recreate that where you live, but it's really key, obviously, to be careful in that space.
Yeah. Lucy, thanks so much for calling. Mary Phillips, our guest today. She leads the National Wildlife Federation's Garden for Wildlife program. Jill Nadeau's our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Phillips. She leads the National Wildlife Federation's Garden for Wildlife program. And again, questions for her, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Ben in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Ben. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I was calling about 2 years ago. I did a prairie restoration with some native seed that I got, and it's a little thin. I'm wondering if I can overseed it. I have some extra seed left over from the seed that I got.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think that would work out well.
It shouldn't be an issue. I'd give it a try at least. You know, seed bed preparation is always kind of the the big thing, yeah. Isn't it, Mary?
Yes. Yeah, no, that's key. And I think, making sure that you have an area that you can disperse it, that the seeds can, be spread evenly. I think that's all part of it. And trying to get out any of the real nuisance weeds that may have come in there before you do that spread.
Thanks again, Ben. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Lynn in Spring Green wondered if bird seed is good for birds. Would it be better to grow the plants they come from?
Well, I am a little personally biased in that area, just because bird seed can offer some challenges. However, there are a lot of reputable bird seed partners out there, like Wild Birds and Unlimited, that can give you really good tips on how to manage and keep your bird feeders clean, as well as our resources at nwf.org. But in the ideal situation, yes, to grow that breakfast kind of buffet for your birds with the seed right from the stem is absolutely ideal.
Diane emailed, she heard you mention a program for planting natives at places of worship, and she wants you to elaborate if you could. She's about to plant her second native garden at her church.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes. So out of our Great Lakes region and out of our DC area offices, we had piloted and have now expanded these sacred grounds programs. And these are exactly what they sound like. We are creating amazing sacred ground at places of worship with amazing native gardens. And it's if you go to nwf.org/sacred grounds, there's all the information about that network and resources. There's a guide for congregations to plant and to educate their membership on why this is important. So really, really great work, particularly Toledo, Detroit, Toledo, the Washington, D.C. area, and several areas in Maryland. And then that's been expanding into other parts of the country.
Are there some photos and so forth up on the site?
Yes, there's photos and there's amazing video of some of these folks installing these gardens and what they turned out to be. They're just beautiful.
So, Diane, I'd certainly encourage you to go to nwf.org/sacred garden.
Sacred ground. That's okay.
nwf.org/sacred ground and take a look. Linda called to ask how she can order the NWF plants if she doesn't have internet access.
Okay. Well, that's a little challenging. So I think we'll have to figure that out and get back to you. We do have primarily this is online. So you could send us an email, but I think you need internet access for that as well. So I'll have to, we're working out on how to do that by mail. We don't have direct USPS mail order at this point.
Linda, you might probably have a friend who has internet access or virtually every public library in the state has internet access, I believe, and it might be worth a trip just to go to over to a friend's place or stop in at the local library, and you're going to get some internet access in that way. Mary, you've been involved in helping monarch butterflies. Tell us about some of that work.
Oh, sure. Well, we've been just so blessed, actually, to work with really great folks, actually, right there in Wisconsin, Karen Oberhauser and the Monarch Joint Venture, for many years, especially starting in 2015, where we really all together worked on a number of monarch recovery strategies. And then that evolved actually into also getting people around the Million Pollinator Garden Challenge. So we've been working across the country with so many great monarch groups and really getting the word out, getting people to work together, developing resources together, just a lot of great work in that space. And the monarch, as you know, it's part of its flyway does come through Wisconsin. So it's really important to support that with a variety of milkweed plantings. And we've been able to, we have a number of resources on our site that tell you the different kinds of milkweed for your specific area.
Have you, by the way, have you heard anything about how well they did over the winter, the monarchs?
Yeah, so we're still waiting for some of those results. They actually have done better in the last year than they've had in the last 20 years. So we're very encouraged by that. And there's also studying the Western monarch population. Those numbers were better this year as well.
Let's go to Helen in Mequonago. Helen, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have quite a few birdhouses, and I wanted to know how to take care of them. Do you have to empty and clean them every year?
Yes, you do. It really does help to keep disease down and keep a fresh place for the birds that come to create their new homes. That's really an essential piece to doing each year. So when you get a birdhouse, it's important to get one that has a flap that you can open and close, and then you shake out that material, dust it out, and make sure it's clean.
Yeah, wash it out. Maybe that's even a good idea, too.
Yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, wash it, too.
Yeah, there you go, Helen. Thank you for calling. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. We mentioned nwf.org/sacred ground, and that relates to churches. Talk about any programs that are set up for schools and for children.
Sure, absolutely. So any school can become a schoolyard habitat, and you can go to nwf.org/certify to certify your school native plant garden at any time. We actually have about 10,000 of those nationwide, which we're really excited. We've seen a real uptick in those as well. And part of our school connections and networks come through our national, which we're part of an international network of called Eco Schools. And Eco Schools help schools go through a checklist of a variety of environmental steps that they can take to be a green school and get green school designation. So those are two ways that we really engage with schools. But we also engage with kids and families through our Ranger Rick magazine, which is over 50 years old and really a great resource for both in the classroom and with parents for kids directly to learn more about wildlife and habitat.
Boy, you brought back some memories when you mentioned Ranger Rick.
Yes.
I loved that magazine when I was a kid.
Yes, it's awesome.
It's full of great stuff. So the program for schools, I mean, does it have to be a big, large area? What?
Oh, no. Good point. Yeah, no, it can be any size, really. You can do, if you are in a small, a school with a smart, not a lot of yard space, or you have a patio or a courtyard, you can create a habitat within those confines. And it can be a combination of plants in the grounds and container plants, which might sometimes, if you have a big window box outside a classroom window, planting some of these smaller native plants so the students can actually observe that wildlife coming and going is an excellent idea. So you can really be flexible with those habitats. The key thing is they need the food, which really the native plants supply. They also supply cover and places for wildlife to raise young. And then you need a water source, like a bird bath or something like a puddling dish for butterflies.
So lots of opportunities there. And schools, I assume, can order plants as well as anybody else.
Yes, absolutely, yes. And we will be sending out some promotions to educators to help them understand how to get those plants.
Okay, so something that you can still do. And let's see here. Oh, I want to give a chance for Kel in Sugar Camp to join us. Kel, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I was wondering if you guys are making packages of nectar and pollen plants for endangered insects, like lupins for the Karner blues, and regional packs for different places mm-hmm. in the United States where we're having insects that are going extinct, mm-hmm. basically. And I thought that might be a good idea to offer something like that.
Thank you so much, Kim. We actually looked into that, and we work closely with our wildlife biologists and our with local DNR. There's a lot of protected areas with dedicated restoration efforts around the Karner blue using lupine, and we right now did not offer it in those areas because that's a controlled kind of process. And so eventually in areas where we can offer it for homeowners and backyards, we will. But right now we wanted to hold off on that. But to your point about other endangered species, I mean, the rusty patch bumblebee is an endangered species in Wisconsin specifically, as well as 28 states overall. It's a generalist bee. And so all the pollen, all the nectar providing plants that you can put in your habitat are going to help those types of endangered species as well. So you've also have the yellow banded bumblebee and others, and then some of your other butterflies and moths like the regal fritterly, I did not say that properly, and others that you can really help. And the Karner blue will benefit as well from a lot of the nectar. Unfortunately, the lupine host plant we're holding off on right now just because we need to work with DNR on that.
Kel, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Phil in Mount Horeb. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Regarding the monarch habitat, and I've always wondered why we don't use our interstate highway corridors, the buffers, the grasses, the medians, for planting of appropriate wildlife-favoring plants, like common milkweed. I wonder if your guest would comment on her effort or ability to use her influence with the federal government to make that kind of thing happen.
Hmm. So thank you for bringing that up. As a matter of fact, in 2016 and 2018, we really had worked very closely with all the state departments of transportation and really worked to have the I-35 corridor be designated as a Monarch Highway. And because each state has its own kind of rules and regulations around that, the good news is several of them along that corridor did get together and sign an agreement to designate that and support roadside monarch and pollinator habitat. And there actually are significant efforts going along the I-35 as well as other areas in the Midwest in that whole corridor that really is from the north, the Minnesota, Wisconsin, all the way down through Mexico. So there's a lot of work, but it's really been more state by state. We did push that federally as well, but there is more of the feeling to leave that to the state designation, state by state.
All right, Phil, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Maybe it wouldn't be, it'd be useful to talk a bit about legislation or things that your organization is working on in that capacity.
Sure. So, like I said earlier, I mentioned the Recovering Americans Wildlife Act, and that is something we're pushing through right now. Would love people to sign on and support that, talk to their legislators about. It is really key in getting funding for state wildlife agencies and tribal nations who all have wildlife plans. This will allow them to have considerable funding to really implement those. And many of them have, as part of their state wildlife plans, a significant monarch recovery plan. So even this idea around roadsides, that's all part of many of these plans. So that's probably the number one thing we're working on that would impact a variety of states across the nation.
I had a question from somebody who has a small backyard, not a large backyard, and doesn't want to turn the whole thing into an area, as you're suggesting. I mean, how much, to make a difference, how much area, you know, is even useful?
Yeah, so you can, as I was saying a little bit earlier, you can do, like, a variety of large containers. You can actually provide, you will see monarchs come, you will see birds and bees come. So you can support them as kind of a mini pit stop in their, travels. And I think then encouraging your neighbors, because the more people have even small spots of habitat, it's a collective impact. And in fact, we just had a study done, we were part of that was funded by the National Science Foundation, where they studied the researchers habitats in suburban areas outside five metro areas across the United States. And we actually saw an increase in bird diversity and turnover of that bird diversity the more concentrated where these certified wildlife habitats were, and also the more concentrations of native plants that you could have on your space. So you don't have to replace everything in your yard, but if you have clusters of these combinations of plants that actually provide three seasons of bloom, you can begin to make a difference.
Yeah, and three seasons of bloom is really useful to have,
yeah.
For sure. We have a little bit of time left. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Give us a call or shoot an email. Russ in Verona, we'll go to you. Russ, hi.
Hi there. How you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to follow up to the call they had regarding highway maintenance in regards to how good it can be. A few years ago, I was down out to a field trip to a nature conservancy place south of Rockford, and we went through this one county. It was on a state highway, or maybe it was interstate. But anyways, someone had mowed the right-of-way, a worker, and they had specifically saved and mowed around every single milkweed.
That's awesome.
I wish we could get Wisconsin to do that. Wisconsin is not very progressive when it comes to their roadside plantings. It's just very unfortunate.
Oh, Thanks, Russ, for calling. Comment, Mary?
No, that's wonderful, and kudos to that facilities person. But you really hit on a key thing. Part of what the states are doing that can make a difference with this is to train and educate their facility managers and their highway maintenance managers to the value of this and giving them those tools to understand that they have the flexibility to mow around the milkweed is absolutely essential.
I think we're getting some calls on this. Maybe talk about again, or just repeat the plants. Give us the general idea of the plants that are available and how people could actually order those plants.
Sure. Thank you so much. So we have several collections, one being Hummingbird Heroes, which is a wonderful collection of tubular red and pastel plants that are really ideal hummingbird attractors. We have the orange milkweed, which is the tuberosa milkweed, which is really ideal for smaller, you know, urban and suburban backyards because it's a more compact milkweed, and it does provide essential benefits to the monarchs. We have a full monarch munchable that offers three seasons of bloom with asters, goldenrod, the milkweed, and then the early spring bee buffet collection as well. And that's at gardenforwildlife.com, and there's a big map at that site, and you click on Wisconsin and you'll get all the collections that are native to Wisconsin.
We and we'll have that link too as well up on our page for today too, under today's note, ideas at wpr.org/Larry, and we'll get that. Mary, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I hope you get a lot of orders for plants from Wisconsin. Thank you.
I hope so. They're grown in Wisconsin and 25% off tomorrow.
Oh, that's right. Order tomorrow when they're 25% off.
Yes.
Oh, that's right. National Garden Day tomorrow. All right. Mary, thanks again. Look forward to another visit from you down the road. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Mary Phillips leads the National Wildlife Federation's Garden for Wildlife program. Sounds like, you know, it's a great program. And here's your chance. I'd order tomorrow if I were in your shoes, because you're going to get the plants 25% off. But in the meantime, you might want to go to the site and take a look and sort of pick out what you might want. Well, the Wisconsin Wetlands Association is presenting a series of virtual talks about wetlands, and I know one of them has to do with whooping cranes, and we'll talk about whoopers and talks about wetlands and plants next. I'm Larry Mueller.